You're listening to the RedCafe.net podcast. Welcome to the RedCafe.net podcast. You can email us at podcast@redcafe.net. Or alternatively, post your opinion on the redcafe.net forums.
Well, it's a pleasure to introduce Andy Mitten on the RedCafe.net podcast. Andy is the founder and editor of the United We Stand fanzine, and he's also a regular writer for the likes of 442 and The Independent. Andy's written a whole host of football books as well, and his most recent publications are the Manchester United version of When Football Was Football and Glory Glory, which is due for release on the 12th of October. Is that right, Andy?
It is. It's coming out on Monday. I'm doing all the publicity stuff for the moment. We're quite a small publisher, so they don't have the huge advertising budget that Dwight York's benefiting from at the moment, for example. I've got some really good stories from players who played in the 90s, plus Martin Edwards, who doesn't normally do interviews, and he invited me to his house. I did spent 3 or 4 hours with him, and he put his side of the story across.
Fantastic. Well, do make sure all our listeners keep an eye out for those two books. Andy, anything else to add on the books? Sort of what are they both about? I mean, you mentioned Glory Glory there, that is sort of an account of former United players, and the Manchester United version of When Football Was Football. That's a photographic book as well, isn't it?
Yeah, When Football Was Football is like a coffee table book of old United images. I got approached and asked to do it by someone who had access to the Daily Mirror's photographic archive going back 100 years. So I went down to Watford, where that is, and I looked for about 10,000 images and narrowed it down to about 500, and then down to about 230, the ones which have made the cut in the book. So there's some beautiful old images in there. Obviously, I had to cover major events in the club's history, such as a Munich air disaster or winning the European Cup in 1968. And the cut-off point is 1992, because that's when the Premier League started, when all the photographic licences came in and newspapers stopped getting unlimited access to football clubs. But what I try to do is reflect the fan culture as well. So there'll be a picture of Oxford United fans running away from the Red Army in 1974-75. Some really good stuff of the Stretford End when it was closed due to trouble in the 70s. A good mixture of black and white and colour pictures. I enjoy doing it. And it's out now. The second book is Glory Glory. I didn't work on both books at the same time. It's just worked out that they both come out at the same time, because Christmas is coming and publishers like to get the books out before Christmas. Glory Glory is the follow-up to a book I did on United in the 80s called We're the Famous Man United, and it follows exactly the same principle. I approached 11 former players, well, 10 plus Martin Edwards, and I said to each of them, I'd like to do an in-depth interview with you about your time at United, about your career. I don't want any cliches. I want you to be honest. I want you to be frank. I want to sit face-to-face and do it with you. And in some cases, I'd spend like 2 or 3 days with people like Jesper Blomqvist. I went to see him in Stockholm. I went to see Eric Cantona in Marseille. I travelled all around Europe. And I went for the most interesting stories. With all respects to Paul Scholes, he's a fantastic player, but he's still playing and he isn't going to say anything. Whereas somebody like Jordi Cruyff has got a brilliant story. He's an articulate lad and he talks about the highs and lows in his life. And I went to meet him in a coffee bar in Barcelona. And before we did the interview, I said, look, Ryan Giggs said that you are the most talented player he's ever trained with. And look, read it. This is his autobiography. And Cruyff read it and you could see his face was starting to bubble. And he said, you know, that's really nice of him to say that, but it makes me angry as well because I never showed it to United fans. And I was an arse. I was an arse at United. I admit I was an arse. And, so straight away, you're getting interesting stuff with these people rather than be fair to the lads. I was happy when I scored this goal. And I'd spent like 4 hours with them, and some of them were very, very interesting. Andrew Cole, I was never going to do him in the book. I didn't have the highest opinion of him when he was a United player in terms of the way he dealt with the media. But I find when players retire, they grow up overnight, they become very mature, more reflective, they live in a real world, they're not in a changing room every day. And Cole was superb. He was really honest, talking about growing up in Nottingham when his dad was a miner during the miners' strike, how difficult it was suffering from racism in Nottingham. Very honest talking about his relationship with people like Teddy Sheringham. And you walk out of an interview like that and you think, I've got to know the person there. You don't see interviews like that in newspapers, because often interviews are done in mix zones, they're done in sound bites, they're done in press conferences. It's not a natural situation. Whereas if you go for a few beers with somebody, I went out clubbing with Blomqvist. I spent 3 days with him. And you sense that you really get under somebody's skin, find out what they're like, and let them give their side of the story, because they've all got their own opinion, including Martin Edwards. I mean, readers of United We Stand largely absolutely loathe Martin Edwards. But I thought, if he's good enough to give me his time, to invite me into his house, I've got to let him have his say. Every player was offered the same amount of money. Some took it, some need it. And some of the lads in the early 90s were not on good money. Several of them gave the money to charity, including Cole, including Edwards. And one of them asked for it to be paid in cash. I'm not going to reveal who that was.
Fantastic stuff. Well, both books sound like brilliant reads. Photographic one and, of course, Glory, Glory. So do keep your eyes peeled for them. Andy, let's move on and ask you some specific football and, of course, Manchester United-based questions. Well, we've got some questions from the RedCafe.net members, and I'll start with one from Lady Barnred. They've asked, who's the politest and rudest United player that you've ever met and why? Because, of course, you've done plenty of interviews during your time working for 442 and other ventures you've done as well.
Many of them have been very polite, so it's probably easiest to start with the rudest ones. Gabriel Heinze, I went into the interview, and it was for United We Stand, and I went in thinking, this is a modern-day hero for United. It was in his first season when he was doing really well. And he didn't want to do the interview. He said, oh, I've got 2 minutes. And I was speaking to him in Spanish. I thought, there's not so many Mancunians who speak Spanish. He might be a bit more open to me. I was asking him about Argentina. And it went okay. But I walked out of it thinking, I don't really like you as a person. You're not really saying to me that you want to be at Manchester United. But I did the interview. He came out of it okay. And only a few weeks ago, I read quotes by Sir Alex Ferguson saying Heinze never wanted to be here. He was always engineering for a move. And looking back, it all fits into place. He just wasn't bothered. Ultimately, the fans are paying his wages. And I would think that we're not going in there and asking too difficult questions. And he wasn't great. Fabian Barthez was famously moody. Nobody at Carrington liked him. A lot of people disliked him. And Mark Bosnich, I once went to interview Raymond van der Hout, and he said, I'm not doing it with that guy in view, and pointed down to Bosnich. And it was very clear that Bosnich was very, very unpopular among Manchester United players. And yet I know other people who've met him, other journalists who say, what a great guy. So it depends on what day you catch people. In terms of the politest, well, most of them are polite because they know that they're being judged when they're being interviewed. So they're not going to come in and be really arsy and aggressive with you, unless your name's Roy Keane. But he's brilliant with it because he's so fired up, and you end up falling out with him during the interview. Peter Beardsley, who obviously played very briefly at United, is a lovely, lovely man. Very, very polite. I remember him standing out. Keane, just for the absolute fascination in everything that he said. And in terms of non-United players, Samuel Eto'o, very similar to Keane, gives you great, great quotes, really thinks about what he says, invites you around to his house, shouts at his wife halfway through the interview, gets a cake brought to you, tells you you've got to go to Cameroon because the women have got the most fantastic breasts, and then a minute later looks at you like you're an absolute idiot because you've asked him a genuine question, which is your brother any good? And he looked at me and said, of course he is. Well, why wouldn't it be? He's my brother. Well, I'm sorry, Samuel, but if he was any good, he would have played a decent level. So he's one who stood out. I remember Rivaldo, he gave me 4 hours of his time at the time when he was arguably the best player in the world, and I always remembered that. And depends on the circumstances how you get to meet somebody. Ruud van Nistelrooy was excellent when I went to see him at Real Madrid last year, because I think he wanted to get a point across to United fans that he was still very fond of the club. He still came to Manchester for a holiday once a year, and he said that, I'm always going to do that. I love the city, I love the people there, and I love United. And I sort of looked across at Real Madrid's press officer and thought, he's going to get in trouble for this. And Ruud said, I don't care, I'm just being honest. So you like that, you appreciate the honesty.
And I want to move back onto your work, Andy. We got an email from Horseless Paul, I believe that's the guy's name. He wants to know if you're doing any more of the rough guide to the season, because he thought they were quite good. They said they were excellent, in fact.
Well, we did the rough guides. We did three of them. And I was approached with Jim White about 7 or 8 years ago. Jim's a big United fan. And we did them together. We enjoyed it. First one sold very well, the second one did okay, and the third one didn't go brilliantly. So the publishers pulled the plug on that one, and that's the reality of publishing. Rough guides ultimately are owned by Penguin, and there'll be some bean counter somewhere saying this needs to be selling X number of copies. My next book after these ones, which will be out in about a year's time, is going to be a rough guide, but it's the rough guide to cult football. So not a United-specific book. Just sorted out Socrates to do the foreword for that one. And he'll do it on the condition that I go to Brazil and do it face-to-face, which would be fine if I lived in Brazil, but it's looked at the flights and the 900 quid. And I've not got a huge budget for that book. So as for Rough Guides to United, there are no plans to be any for there to be any at the moment, sadly, but that's out of my hands.
Excellent. Well, Yazir, he's asked a question, a really interesting question, actually. What would be your sort of all-time Manchester United 11?
Of players as opposed to personalities, and I'm thinking off the top of my head here, so I'm probably going to leave myself open, and I'm going to choose players who I've seen myself. Schmeichel as a goalkeeper. He certainly wouldn't be in there if it was for his personality or him as a person, but he was an outstanding goalkeeper. Although Van der Sar's has had a great career as well. Gary Neville, not always seen eye to eye with him, and you can't see me smirking there, but he's not a big fan of United We Stand and the fanzine culture, but he has been an excellent right back, an excellent club captain. Two central defenders, very, very fond of Bruce and Pallister, did Pallister for the Glory Glory book, and I went up to his house and he just lay on his sofa scratching his balls for 3 hours, which apparently... was all he did when he was a player as well, except he had a big bag of waivers which he kept dipping into. But I think that Vidic and Ferdinand, although they're not having the best of seasons this year, technically they are more athletic than Bruce and Pallister were. Football's changed. I think I would have to go with them two. Left back, Evra's outstanding and completely crackers. But he's brilliant. Dennis Irwin was brilliant as well. Jordi Cruyff pulled Dennis Irwin out. He said, you know, what a guy, played all those years for Man United, took free kicks, took penalties, and was an unsung hero all the time. I'd play a 4-4-2. I think that's the United way. Roy Keane as a central midfielder, probably the best Manchester United player I've ever seen consistently. Great for interviews as a journalist as well, even if he'd berate you as often as he'd come up and sort of trust you and give you good stuff. And a great club captain during, some very, very happy years watching the club. Giggs on the left, he'll probably be remembered better than anybody. I played against Giggs when I was 13, 14. He played for Dean Sports. I played for Victoria Boys in Stretford. I played as a right back. He played on the left wing. I got absolutely destroyed by him. Ryan Wilson, he was called. Our team always used to beat his, but I was always substituted. And at half-time, my manager or my dad or whatever, they'd just look at me and just say, I know what you're saying. I couldn't get close to him. So Giggs on the left. Probably Ronaldo on the right. I mean, David Beckham was a very good player and a big United fan and still is. But Ronaldo was the first player to win the European Footballer of the Year Award, World Player of the Year. Since the 60s, all those goals in the 2008 season, I don't think that'll ever be bettered by a non-forward. Alongside Keane in the middle, I'd have Paul Scholes. You often speak to players and they all say he's the best player in training, best player on the pitch. And he reminds me very much of someone like Xavi or Iniesta at Barcelona. Very unassuming, wonderful footballer, a real footballer's footballer. As a journalist, it's frustrating because he never wants to speak, and he knows that. He just walks past, smirks at you, laughs at you, and says, you know, I don't say anything anyway. Well, that's his personality. Up front, Eric. I think most United fans would have Eric in there, just for the way that he changed the club when he came in. The league hadn't been won since 67. The 92-93 season wasn't going well when he came in. I remember Arsenal away, United weren't scoring goals in the November. And he changed the whole dimension of the club. It became a cliche that he was the final piece in the jigsaw, which was. But more than that, he was a real character off the field, and we're still seeing that today. I love the fact that he lived in Boothtown in a very unassuming three-bed semi, that he went to the corner house. He was just the anti-footballer. He was the anti-star. He didn't turn up at black tie dinners wearing black ties, and because he was Eric, he got away with it, which really used to piss the other players off. And a lot of them told me stories in Glory where they're saying that, you know, they were really angry at the time because they felt Eric was being singled out for special treatment. Up alongside Eric, Van Nistelrooy's goal rate was brilliant. Mark Hughes was a childhood hero, although he is not a hero of mine anymore because he manages a team who, well, they don't win trophies, so I don't suppose we should worry about it. I love Joe Jordan was the first player. I had a poster of him in my bedroom when I was a kid. I used to love him without ever knowing why. I don't suppose Cantona and Joe Jordan would make an orthodox front pairing, but I'll go with that one.
Excellent stuff. Well, lots of legends there. I'm sure I'll be covering a lot of them in the coming weeks. But I want to go to a more general football question, Andy, if that's all right.
Yeah, no problem.
Got a question from Castolo, and he wants to know what your opinion is on reintroducing standing at English grounds. Probably something like the sort of German model where they've got sort of standing areas, something like that. Do you think that's something that could happen or should it happen?
I would be in favour of it. I'm going to go to Germany before the Wolfsburg game, and I'm going to go and stand on the big cop at SV Hamburg to see it myself, and I'm going to go watch a game in Berlin on the Saturday. I'm a big fan of the German model from what I've seen, partly because the ticket prices are very low, because you can get more people into the same area. The atmosphere is a lot better, and I think the decline in atmosphere at Old Trafford has been well documented throughout the 90s, and the all-seater stadia were an important factor in that. People have got older inside the stadium. I know myself, when I was 17, I used to take an air horn into the match, and it used to really annoy people around me. I'd have a flag, I'd try and start songs off, and I don't do that now. A part of it is growing up, but on its day, Old Trafford can still be brilliant. I'm not one of these people who just says, it's gone, it's rubbish, it's not like it was, because for the Barcelona game in the Champions League last year, it was absolutely brilliant. The place was rocking, and I took a Barca fan to it, and he just said, this is amazing, we never see anything like this in Spain. I would be in favour of it. I think the clubs are dead against it. One, because it would cost them money. Two, because they feel like they don't have control of the supporters. And they'll always go back to the Hillsborough argument, saying that happened on a terrace. But I think that safe standing can and should work. But politically, and I've asked various sports ministers this over the last 10 years, I don't think that there is a sway for that opinion. I think it's for another generation, sadly.
Well, Green Demons asked about your view on clubs poaching youngsters, Andy. It's been in the news a lot recently, and with United as well, with Paul Pogba. So what's your view on that?
Well, I've got a story which is very close to home here, because my little brother is 15 years old. He didn't have a club a year ago. He got spotted by Stockport County. He became a footballer last season at Stockport County, did exceptionally well. And at the end of the season, Stockport's coaches pulled my dad and his mum aside and said, keep his feet on the ground, he's very, very good. Now, all my family have played football. I'm the only one who pays to play. I'm the black sheep of the family, the one who's never been good enough. But none of them have had the pace of my little brother, apart from my Uncle Charlie, who was obviously a big star into Matt Busby's first team. And Stockport County went bust in June. And the following day, Manchester United got in touch with Stockport County and said, we would like to offer Sam Mitten a trial. And we were all delighted. And he went on a trial at Carrington. United have one trial each year for that age group, and he scored a hat-trick. And a couple of the coaches rang me the next day and said, you didn't tell us about him. There's a few expletives in there as well. You didn't tell us about him. And I thought, I didn't know what his standard was. I just want him to enjoy his football. He had two further trial games, did very well. And Manchester United said, we want to take him. Stockport, obviously they're going to lose one of their best players at that age group. And they felt that they asked for money. And they said Manchester United were very, very professional in the way that they dealt with my little brother. I told my brother to stay out of it. I told my parents, stay out of it. I said, let the club sort it out between themselves. Don't get a reputation for being difficult. And they did sort it out between themselves. If he was to go on and make it, if he was to get a professional contract, Stockport would be very well compensated. They'd get a lot of money for a lad they've only had for 1 year. So I think that's very fair. Sam went to Carrington on Saturday on his BMX, picked his kit up, and then he went to Old Trafford and sold United where he stands. So it's like it's been a dream so far. He's got 6 weeks at Carrington now. He's training four times a week. He isn't the brightest lad, so if he don't make it as a footballer, he's absolutely goosed. But he's in our own experience, very close to the family, Manchester United have been very professional. Now, Stockport could go and cry and say, they're nicking all our best players. Naturally, United are going to get the best players at some point. It might work out for him, it might not. We'll keep his feet on the ground. If it doesn't work out, he can go back to Stockport. But in that one experience, Manchester United have been exceptionally professional so far. Further afield, because Sam's finding himself playing with lads from all around the world, even though he only lives a mile from Carrington, it's an ethical question. You know, do you take a young French lad? The French teams are up in arms about it, but the African teams are up in arms that the French clubs are taking their players. There are laws there. The problem is parents' heads get turned. It's a difficult one. I think that the smaller clubs should be well compensated.
Well, Sam Mitten, I'll be keeping my eyes out for him. Hopefully a star for the future there.
Indeed it is. And Andy, we spoke about the team from across the town earlier. We've got a question from Red Spoonie. He asks, do you think that City, with all their mega money and their infinite budget, etc., do you think they'll ever become the biggest team in Manchester?
No. They've had that time, and that was enough for the good people of Manchester. That was before the war, when they won a trophy. And they might have won more than one. They lent us the ground after the war, and that was City doing their good turn. I think that while Alex Ferguson is at the club, Manchester City will not be bigger than Manchester United. We mock City, we mock them all the time in United. We stand, we rip out of them. If I'm being honest, I've got some good mates. They support City. They go home and away with City. They've gone home and away for years with City. I like them. I respect these lads. And they're enjoying what's going on now because they've watched in the main rubbish for a long, long time. And they say, of course, we're not comfortable with the funding, but the way the club's run, but I'm sure you're not at United either. They're loving the fact that they can go to Old Trafford and give United a decent game. I think that they're enjoying an upwards trajectory. I think that Mark Hughes is a good manager. He irritates me far more often these days. I think he does with all United fans, but if I'm being objective and speak to people in football about him, he scores well on the grapevine. But I don't think that they will surpass United so quickly. They'll throw a lot of money at it, but it isn't just about buying individuals. Sir Alex Ferguson has created a team spirit which is second to none. He controls the club. He's such a dominant figure. He gets the best out of players. I think that we have the best manager in the world at Manchester United. I think City will improve. They might even get in the top four this year, but while Ferguson's there, United will remain the biggest team.
Fantastic. Well, Crazy Robus, he's got in touch with a question about the Glazers and asking what you make of them and just the general sort of financial health of the club as well.
They worry me because Manchester United were so successful before 2005. It was virtually the only football club in the world which made money, and serious money. And when clubs floated on the stock market, like Aston Villa, Tottenham, even Preston North End, the shares just died away. Manchester United's didn't, because it was a very well-run company. Now, I'm not comfortable talking about clubs as companies, but United were very, very well run. The merchandising was exploited. They used that money to do the stadium. And it was a circle of success, more investment, more success. The best players started to come in. And not so long ago that Manchester United couldn't compete with teams like Tottenham for players. You know, in 1991, Tottenham had a higher turnover than Manchester United. And the team would make a lot of money each year. And then the Glazers have come in. And I try and be fair, I try and be objective about it, but I cannot get away from my gut reaction is that they're not football people. It's an investment for them. They've borrowed money and the club are in debt to the hilt. Ticket prices are increasing at a rate unseen at any other club. Most clubs, including the likes of Chelsea, are holding the prices. United's are still going up. I don't think that's right. I think that they will squeeze as much as they can out of the current Manchester United model. They're not around for the long term. They'll sell as soon as it becomes a good business proposition to sell. As people, I know people who've met them said they're perfectly pleasant. They're nice people. But as a Manchester United supporter, it worried me when they took over, and it worries me now. The club are £700 million in debt, and it just annoys me. That I'm proud that United are the best supported club in Europe, that the stadium's full every week, that you go on holiday wherever in the world and people know Manchester United. You know, Manchester's a provincial northern city. It isn't London, it isn't New York, and yet Manchester United is a huge name around the world. And the people who will ultimately make the cash benefit out of that will be a family in Florida who will extract what they can and sell it like a commodity. And that fills me with sadness.
Well, we'll get to more upbeat topics, shall we say, Andy. Just go back to you, back to sort of your experiences and stuff like that. What was the first match that you seen at Old Trafford? And have you got any special memories from when you were there?
Yeah, you know, when I was a little kid, I didn't go that much because all my family played football. So every Saturday I was watching my dad play. From the age of 3 or 4, he played semi-pro. So I'd be travelling around the north of England with him, going to Mad Grounds in Liverpool and at Barrow and Southport and Radcliffe. And I would always say, Dad, to take me to Old Trafford. And he never did. He said, I'm a player, I'm not a watcher. And it wasn't until I was able to go by myself at like 12 or 13 that I started going all the time. Of course, I've been taken a few times when I was like 9 or 10. I think the first game I was 9 against Ipswich Town, and we got beaten. I stood in the Stretford paddock and it was about 80 pence to get in, something like that. But the first time I properly started going, as soon as I was 13, I bought a league match ticket book for about £34 in the Stretford End. Used to go there every week, get the bus from Urmston. The bus was full of United fans, full of kids. It's not anymore, which is really sad. And I'd queue up to get into the ground, and I would wait for 2 hours, the right side of the Stretford End, watching the atmosphere build. There were all the characters. I really looked up to these older guys. They were probably only 17 or 18, but I thought they were like, you know, men for me. And they'd have all the, get the chance going. There'd be a big banter with the left side or a bit behind the tunnel in the Stretford End. And for big games like Liverpool at home, everyone would get there earlier. The atmosphere would start to build. There'd be crushes. It was just, I've got really happy memories of standing on the Stretford End as a kid. And I don't want to harp back to it too much because it has changed an awful lot. But I've got their memories and I will always have them. And ironically, the football wasn't very good, but it just didn't seem to matter. If you were singing and enjoying it, and singing anti-Cockney or anti-Scouse songs, you just go on with a big smile on your face.
Well, Andy, you've already mentioned quite a few sort of funny stories that where you've interviewed United players. But is there anything that really sticks out, a really particularly funny or embarrassing moment when you've interviewed a United player from the past or present team?
Embarrassing for me, there's a few, and again, Roy Keane comes down to it. I interviewed him in a foyer in Philadelphia in 2004 for United We Stand. Give me a brilliant interview, absolutely brilliant. We were there for an hour and a half, and United's press officer came over at the end and said, are you still here? And because Roy was club captain and he was this all-powerful figure, he could say, yeah, he is. And he had the power. And Roy asked for a copy approval to see the interview, and he didn't take anything out, which I thought fair play to him, because there was some pretty dodgy stuff in there, which we had to leave out for legal reasons. And I knew that, I said, Roy, this is, all the papers are going to rob this. You know, you've given it to a fanzine, all the papers are going to rob it. And what I did, I did a deal with several newspapers where I got money off them, with Roy knowing, in advance, and I give all that money to non-league clubs in Manchester. And Keane knew what was going on. This is a side of Keane that never got in the paper. So I thought, rather than clubs just taking it. And then I got a phone call 2 weeks later. Picked up my phone. Andy Roy came. Now, I speak to these people all the time, but it's not that often that the captain of Manchester United rings you up when you're at home doing a fanzine. And he called me a little whatever, but in a very endearing manner, and said, you can help me now. Because he knew he'd given me a brilliant interview. And he said, I'm looking at buying a place in Barcelona. You're obviously there a lot. Can you help me? I said, of course I can. So I did a load of research for him. I said, and I rang him back. I said, this is where the Barca players live. This is what you'd be paying. That area is good, but probably not for someone of your profile. And I said, if you need any help getting a mortgage, I've just bought a place in Barcelona. And as I'm saying it, I'm thinking, why am I telling someone who earns 90 grand a week if he needs a mortgage advisor? And he just said, I'll be all right, thanks. But it was just a fantastic put down. And he's living in a different world. But that's Roy Keane. Lots of embarrassing stories where you might slip up, say the wrong thing. But I think if a player knows you're well-intentioned and you're not being snide, then they can be quite forgiving.
Excellent stuff. I love these stories you've got, and they're fantastic. want to go on to another general football question. Obviously, you've covered a lot of different games around the world and stuff like that. What, in your opinion, is the most heated, passionate, craziest derby in world football that you've seen?
I'm going to pick out several, because for very different reasons, and I'll highlight them. Glasgow Rangers against Celtic is vicious for reasons well beyond football. And I sat in the main stand at Ibrox for that one. The whole stand, the whole stadium, apart from the Celtic end, was bouncing to the strains of Big Jock New, which, if you look into it, is a story relating to allegations of paedophilia at Celtic Park. And the director's box was bouncing, people were hugging each other. The place was absolutely rocking. And I just thought, this is hatred. This is just pure sectarian bigotry. But there's also something, as a spectacle, when you're in that game and you hear the atmosphere, it's absolutely brilliant in terms of the noise level. So Glasgow is vicious, and far more so than any English derby, if I'm being honest. I went to Belfast, and along similar lines, you sort of sense that it went beyond football. I went to Israel, where there's a big game there between Maccabi Tel Aviv and Hapoel Tel Aviv. I heard songs about the Holocaust, about the various concentration camps, about the Palestinians, and I just thought, I can't believe I'm at a football game here. People are using this as a vehicle to get a political message across, and there was absolute hatred there. In Italy, it's very passionate. Roma-Lazio is a big, big game. And yet I seem to walk into the only Roma-Lazio game when peace broke out. I had a mad experience there. I turned up at the ticket office. They said, we don't have a ticket for you. I said, but I've got a boat here. I've just caught a boat to Rome to write about this game. Sorry, we don't have a ticket for you. They said, give me a passport. So I gave this lady a passport. And they had an Italian lad with me who was going to be a translator. A very suave, good-looking lad who tried to work his charm. And she came back to me 20 minutes later and said, I'm sorry, we can't give you a ticket. I said, well, give me my passport back. She said, what passport? I said, I gave you my passport. Yeah. She said, you didn't. So suddenly I'm in Rome without a ticket, without a passport, and it's the day before Good Friday, when all the embassies are closed, when Rome's full of tourists, and I'm thinking I've got to fly back to Manchester because it was a big United match. What on earth am I going to do? Italian kid worked his magic with a beautiful assistant at Lazio, got us two tickets, walked into the ground where Francesco Totti, the Roma captain, was presenting a wreath in front of the Lazio ultras. There was a minute's silence because one of the Lazio ultras had been killed by police. Both sets of supporters, who usually hate each other, started applauding each other there was this massive loving. So I've gone to write about this game of hate, and they're all applauding each other. And then it all goes quiet, and it comes over to Tannoy in Italian, Andrew Mitten, passaporte. And someone, the lady had taken my passport. She'd inadvertently handed it out with some exec tickets. They'd handed it into the police. I got down there. They gave me my passport back. It was 3-2 to Lazio, last-minute winner. All well and ended well. It was fantastic.
That was a vicious derby, Andy. I'll tell you that much. But you got on a good day. I remember that day as well. It was a good day.
Yeah. I think other derby matches, the game in Buenos Aires, I watched River Plate play in February this year. The atmosphere in Argentinian football is exceptional. And in terms of atmospheres at United matches, I always remember the Vasco da Gama Manchester United game in the Maracanã. There were about 400 United fans there, just being totally outsung by 50,000 Vasco fans. And I can hear the songs in my head now. It was so impressive. So the South American fans, they leave us to shame, unfortunately. And yet they really look up to British football. They look up to English football and the English fans, and there are certain virtues such as the loyalty and the consistencies of the attendances that are very admirable in English football. But in terms of the derbies, there's great games all around the world, and at every level, you know, Chester Wrexham, it's a working class, middle class thing between Wales and England. Orlando Pirates against Kaiser Chiefs in South Africa, it's built on grudge and ego and a lust for power. There's always good stories in derby matches.
Just really quickly, Andy, I mean, Fergie's mentioned that he sees Liverpool as the big derby. Is that the same for you, or are you still sort of you prefer the City game, obviously, because you mentioned you have City friends?
Yeah, I think Liverpool are the only team who can lay serious claim to being United rivals. They're huge around the world. They've got a similar fan base to United, although it's smaller. And they've got a trophy cabinet which they can be proud of. They're still doing it despite being under-resourced. I think that the rivalry transcends football. It's social, it's economic between Manchester and Liverpool. You can't consider City to be the same level of rivals when they haven't won anything since the 16th century. But it's definitely Liverpool.
OK, and just finally, Andy, tell us a bit about United We Stand. I mean, I've heard and read that you started it when you at the age of 15. So exactly what sort of gave you the inspiration to get that going in the first place?
Started it 20 years ago last Friday in roommate at Bradfield Road at school, when I was bored in a maths class in Urmston in Manchester. I was an angry young man who felt that football fans didn't have a voice, that decisions were being made on behalf of football fans. The issues like ID cards at the time, everybody thought football fans were scum. And the football fanzine movement started off the back of that. And I got very lucky because the magazine started going very, very well. And I never intended it to. I was 15. By the time I was 18, I did a journalism degree. And I only got onto that course because I did United We Stand. And then when I'd done my journalism degree, United asked me to edit their official magazine, which I didn't want to do because I wanted to carry on doing United We Stand. And I've carried on doing United We Stand. It's 20 years old now. It's I only spend about a quarter of my time doing it. But we've got a great team of people. We've done 188 issues. I'm very passionate about it, and you know, I can do all these fancy jobs for big newspapers and slick magazines, but I can't replicate the buzz when a new issue of United We Stand comes out and you get it from the printers, and it's full of opinions. I agree with some of them in there, I don't agree with others, but it's still a buzz, and I'll continue to do it as long as it remains a buzz.
And then one final question. Earlier on in the show we did a legend who is a legend of a brilliant manager, a great guy, Sir Matt Busby, and one of your relatives, Charlie Mitten, he played under him famously. Is there anything you could maybe tell us about Charlie that we maybe don't know?
Yeah, but it's all bad. He carried on cashing my great grandmother's pension book for 8 months after she passed away, so that didn't cover him in glory with the rest of the family. I've only ever been asked for money to do an interview once. That was by my old uncle Charlie. He said, oh, 100 quid. I said, but Charlie. And then just before he died, I went to see him. He was in a nursing home at Stile. And I'd grown up going to see him each Sunday. Brilliant stories about his career. Real character. I'm told he was a great, great player. A real rogue. Into gambling. Lost a lot of money gambling. Really into his greyhounds. To the point that when he was manager at Newcastle, Ivor Allchurch, the big centre forward for Newcastle, was told to wait outside the physio's room, and when he peeked inside, one of Charlie's greyhounds was being massaged. That had priority over the number nine at Newcastle. So he was a rogue, and he was very cynical about the way that football had become. And he said, you know, can you get Di Stefano to come and see me and push gas? I said, I can't. How can I do that? You know, I just couldn't do it. But I've got happy memories of Charlie. He loved football. He was a fantastic player, and he had a great story. You know, being one of the first British players to play abroad when he went over to Bogota. To do that in 1950, in at a time when the world was very different, I think that was quite brave of him. I know that he regretted not joining Real Madrid after that. But he had a great life story. I just think he felt that he played all these years, was very famous, and never had anything to show for it, whereas the players ever since his generation, even from the 60s onwards, they were all quite wealthy, and Charlie didn't have anything, and I think he was quite bitter about that.
Well, I'm sure Dob will agree, and I hope the listeners agree. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Andy. You've given us some fabulous insights into United and the world of football as well. So thanks very much for joining us today, Andy.
It's been very nice to speak to you. I really enjoyed it, and good luck with the podcast.
Andy, I believe we have a competition being run on the redcafe.net forums next week as well, where the winner will receive a copy of the publication When Football Was Football. So that's definitely an incentive for our listeners to get involved as well. So, yeah, once again, thanks a lot, Andy.
Sound. And if any of them are in Manchester, we're doing a book signing with Andrew Cole on the 29th at WH Smith in the Trafford Centre at 6 o'clock. And for When Football Was Football, doing one with Paddy Crerand on Friday the 23rd at 6 o'clock at Waterstones in the Trafford Centre. So come and meet Paddy. He's absolutely crackers. I'll tell you some stories about him.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Andy, and you take care.
Take care, Stephen. Take care, Dob. Bye-bye.